What's up, UXers? Today I want to introduce you to my friend Imogen Levy, the head of digital at Moorfields Eye Hospital. Moorfields Eye Hospital is a part of the UK's NHS, the National Health System, and they have over 30 locations. So Imogen is not only a certified OUX strategist, but also an active mentor in the OUX forum and an emerging leader in this space. She's heavily using object-oriented UX to shepherd Moorfields through a true digital transformation. And I mean that in the truest sense. That is not just a platitude. She is taking their digital properties from basically what she calls, to paraphrase, glorified showcases of PDFs that are just rife with repeated and outdated and unstructured content, to really an organization that is thinking about their content and their patient experience very strategically. And she's going to talk all about how she's doing that. Imogen also spoke at OUX Happy Hour, and you can find a link to her talk in the show description. Or you can just search Imogen Levy, OUX, and you should find it just fine. So we are trying to get more of our content on YouTube. We have a backlog of recordings of happy hours and all sorts of other good stuff, and we're just trying to clean things up there. So if you do go over to YouTube, please help us out. Just Hulk smash that subscribe button and like it and comment on it and do all the good things to help us out on YouTube. Give us a little bit of a boost on that platform. All right, so I have just a few updates for you before we jump into the conversation with Imogen. So first is some good news in the OUX job world. It's OUX jobs are really becoming a thing, actually. So when I spun up the job board within the OUX forum about a year ago, the OUX forum is just for certified or certifying OUX strategists. But when I first spun up the job board about a year ago, we got maybe 1 to 2 posts a month of OUXers looking for more OUXers to join their team. Now it's like we're getting 2 to 3 posts a week. So if you're still considering getting certified, but you're not sure if it will actually help you out in the job market, I can confidently say that it will. So it'll help you with your design challenges when you're interviewing. Just having OUX on your resume or on your portfolio site, even if people don't know what object-oriented UX is, they're going to be curious about it. They'll want to ask about it. But once you get in the door, you'll be able to you'll be able to talk about object-oriented UX, show how it helps you work strategically. But on top of that, just you'll be within this network of people that are looking for other OUXers. So pretty much everyone who goes through the course just gets ruined in the fact that going forward, they only want other OUXers to join their team. They want people that are thinking this way. So at least for anyone that's doing any sort of strategic information architecture or UX system design. So if you're not already on the wait list for cohort 5, go to oouX.com/certification and click on that big green button at the bottom to get on the wait list. And if you are a certified OUX strategist and you haven't checked out the job board recently, go check that out. There's lots of jobs at Lowe's, Apple, AzuleArc is hiring as well. And that's just the ones that I'm thinking of. Alzheimer's Society. That's just what I'm thinking of off the top of my head. So just you can go into the topics, go to job board and check it out. So now this is going to get announced in next week's newsletter, but you'll hear it here first. So thanks for listening. We have a date. Cohort 5 is going to kick off on August 30th in Run Hard for 10 weeks, going through November 1st, I believe. So I feel like that's really nice timing. Hopefully you'll get to recharge a little bit over the summer. Hopefully you have some vacation planned. And then you can just jump into getting just upskilling. That's such a silly word. Just upgrading your problem-solving skills before things slow down again for the holidays. So go get on the wait list, oUX.com/certification. And you will be the second group of people to know when enrollment opens up. The second group? What? This is the second group? You're on the wait list. So, yes. So, to be the first to know, that is going to be those that have already invested in the self-paced masterclass. So, basically, those are folks that have made a down payment on the certification. So thank you so much if that's you. So this is how it works. So when you purchase the self-paced masterclass, you're going to get an instant credit toward putting that full cost of the self-paced masterclass toward a future certification. All right, so you don't pay twice. You don't pay for the content twice. So the self-paced masterclass, it's all of the content. It's just, it doesn't have the community, the feedback, the white glove treatment from me, one-on-ones and everything. And because I'm not looking at all of your assignments or any of your assignments in the self-paced masterclass, you're basically on your own. You don't get the certification, of course, because I can't say that you for sure know this stuff. If you are interested in doing that and kind of just diving into the content and not waiting until August 30th, please make sure to subscribe to the newsletter if you are not already. That's oux.com/newsletter so that you can find out on Monday the discount code. So next week, the week of the 28th, I believe, June 28th, if you're listening to this in somewhat real time, that's going to be the lowest price that you will possibly be able to see. So more on that in the newsletter. Make sure to subscribe to the newsletter and you'll get all the updates on that. Okay, enough sort of salesy stuff. I got one quick process update for you before we jump into the conversation with Imogen. So what I want to talk about today as far as developments within OUX and the Orca world, let's talk about attribute prioritization. So attribute prioritization, it is the A of Orca. So of course, Orca is objects, relationships, calls to action, and attributes. And we iterate on those four things to basically pull all of our research and create structure from our research that we can create wireframes from. So attribute prioritization is basically the last thing that you do. It's the A of Orca in the prioritization round. It's the last step before we get into sketching. So it's where we have our object map. We've hammered on our object map. We figured out all the details. And now we want to prioritize all those attributes. So we're shuffling them around. We're doing a forced ranking of every column in our object map. So when I first started thinking about this, I call it sketching with sticky notes. Like pretty much I'm doing a very low fidelity sketch of a detail page. So let's say the column is event. All right. So I've got the name of the event. I've got an image. I've got the description. I've got the time. I've got the date. I've got the duration. I've got the status, whether it is a private event or a public event. I've got whether it's in another status, maybe whether it's in the past or whether it's in the future. So this is when I go in and I take all those attributes and I say, all right, actually date is going to be more important than description. So I'm sort of sketching out what that detail page would look like. That's how I talked about it originally. Then I started moving away from that and thinking, you know what? There's how you visually prioritize something and there's how you sort of semantically prioritize something. And we need to be thinking more about how you semantically prioritize. And that was tough. That was tough for people. And it was really, so I kind of went back on that and said, you know, however you really want to do it, do you want to do it semantically or visually? We have been doing here at Rewired quite a bit of work on accessibility and actually got some apps and just help see how a screen reader reads our sites. It's been very, very interesting. The shift that I've kind of gone back to that semantic thinking about when we prioritize our attributes, but doing it specifically, prioritize your attributes on how a screen reader would read it. So this is really going to help us pull away from this idea of like visually you can almost take in two pieces of information at once, but on a screen reader, it is one piece of information at a time. It cannot voice two pieces of information at once. So you have to make that call. What is the proper order for any object? How should a screen reader talk about that? How should a screen reader read out those attributes? So this does turn into a combination of grouping and prioritization. This has been so helpful for me to sort of continue to remove visual hierarchy from my thinking and to really think semantically and what that experience is going to be from a screen reader perspective. That's how you need to order it in your object map. That's how you should be thinking about attribute prioritization. So I hope that helps. Please tweet at me if you have any thoughts on that or any feedback on that at SophiaVUX. Okay, let's go learn from the wise, the charming, and the delightful Imogen Levy. Welcome to the Object Oriented UX Podcast, a podcast about tackling complexity head on, gracefully organizing massive amounts of information, and designing scalable, future-proof, and of course, naturally intuitive object-oriented user experiences.
An OUXer is a powerful blend of information architect, business analyst, facilitator, and UX strategist. If this sounds like you or what you aspire to, you are so in the right place. I'm Sophia Prater, UX designer, chief evangelist of Objector UX, and your host. Let's jump into it. Imogen, welcome to the Objector UX podcast.
Thank you for having me. Great to be here. Thank you.
Yeah, I'm really excited about our conversation. So you are a certified OUX strategist and have been using object-oriented UX at Moorfields Eye Hospital for quite a while now, a few months now. You're pretty deep in it. So before we actually dig into all the geekiness of going into object-oriented UX, can you just kind of give us a peek into your daily life? Like, what does a day in the life look like being the head of digital at Moorfields?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I don't think I have a typical day. I think that's kind of the beauty of the role, I guess, in some ways. I do spend a lot of my time in meetings, collaborating with lots of different stakeholders across the organization. So a lot of my role is really trying to build, I guess, coalition across the trust. Particularly in terms of boosting a kind of user-centered design approach, design thinking, that kind of is relatively new in the space that I work in. People are doing it more at a kind of national level, but certainly when you get to kind of hospital level, local level, more kind of on the front line type stuff, digital teams are fairly low in resource. So it's an interesting space to work in because I part of my job is really trying to educate, empower, I guess, the organization to think differently about digital. So that's kind of one key aspect of my role. Lots of that is strategizing, discussing, planning, thinking kind of big vision stuff. And then the other part is leading at the moment a delivery team to actually build a new product for Moorfields, which as an exemplar, I guess, for demonstrating all the stuff that I talk about that we need to do. So really those two aspects, product development, product design, doing the stuff, and then really talking about it and building up the kind of, you know, the coalition and you know, really exciting two aspects of my role, really.
So when you're talking to all these stakeholders and sort of kind of getting everybody on the same page, do you feel like you're still doing a lot of selling to get people on board with user-centered design? Are people open to it? You're just kind of explaining what that means, or are you still sort of having to kind of get them on board with the whole idea of we need to be thinking about our users?
A bit of both, I'd say. I think. I mean, I can go from meetings like, you know, what's wrong with a PDF kind of conversation to, setting a kind of vision for digital for the next 5 years. So it kind of really ranges in that kind of broad spectrum that yes, some people really get it and are really excited by the potential of digital. And that really helps in having those kind of conversations that are relatively easy. But there's also stakeholders and people I work with who really don't understand or don't get it. And that, you know, and so really both of those camps that I deal with kind of on a daily basis. Mm-hmm. And I guess that's why I enjoy the role that I do, that no day is the same. And it is, you know, it is a challenge to do that and to sort of be a bit of a change maker in an organization. But it's also really exciting when you can see people start to really get it. And I've been in the organization a year and a half now, and already in that year and a half have seen change, you know, change in ways of working together, change in mindset, in ways of thinking about things. And that's really exciting. You know, we've got a long way to go, but when you can really start to see that happen, mm-hmm. you know, that gives you the boost to kind of carry on, I suppose.
Yeah. And I mean, I guess that's really probably very fulfilling. I mean, being at a place where there is so much room for improvement, you know, and a place that is, you know, very in a, helping people in a very, very real way. And I can see that takes a lot of patience and also humility to be able to go from like that big picture strategy, this is why we need to do this, to that, like, this is what's wrong with a PDF conversation. And you probably have had that conversation, you know, like, I need to have this conversation for the 15th time, but that's all right, because we need to get people on board with this.
Yeah, so I literally just, somebody just mentioned earlier today in a conversation that you need to hear it 21 times in order to like understand something, which is just and actually that's, you know, even if I have those conversations 21 times, like, great. If at the 21st conversation you're going to get it, I am willing to have 21 conversations that are the same.
I think that's going to be really motivating for a lot of people to hear who may be on like the 13th or 14th time they've had the conversation. So just know there is a light at the end of the tunnel. You might need to have the conversation another 10 times, but people will start to, it'll start to click for people and people will start understanding and, you know, you will start to see that change.
And consistency is key as well. You know, so ever since I started, the story has been the same. So I've never been anything but kind of consistent with the message. And that also really helps. Like, I haven't changed my mind about where we're going. The vision is very kind of, you know, it's set. We're really clear on the direction. And that really helps, again, you know, getting people kind of on board with this stuff because I'm not changing my mind. I've set the direction and that is where we're going. I'm nothing but kind of consistent and that really helps. And that, you know, stakeholders who have given me feedback who have said, you know, one thing I really like about your approach is that you're always saying the same thing. I can really understand you and you're really clear and direct. So that really helps. So yeah, you do have to have the conversation more a lot, but it will pay off. And yeah, consistency is key.
I can see that from experience of being at organizations where the vision, I would feel like every time I would meet with leadership, it was like a bullet hitting a tin can. It would just like be like, pew, okay, the vision's going in that direction now. The vision's going in that direction. And it was, I think it was not only confusing for those outside of the design group, but for the people within the design group, you know, being under that kind of leadership where the vision was always changing. That's one of the main reasons some of the organizations, I left those organizations because the vision was always changing and it was hard to get momentum on anything. And like, so how do you balance like getting that clear, consistent vision and also sort of baking learning in and knowing when you need to be flexible and like, oh, we need to, I'm using the air quotes, we need to pivot now. We need to maybe like, I've learned new things and maybe we do need to change direction a little bit.
Yeah, I think the most important thing for me when you're setting a kind of vision is that the vision has to be aspirational enough, but not specific that you're going to tie your shoelaces together. Mm-hmm. And I'm having these kind of active conversations with stakeholders this week exactly about that. So we're currently undergoing an organizational refresh of our strategy, of which digital is a really key component. And one of the main things is setting a direction that covers you for, you know, the next 5 years kind of comfortably, but isn't specific in terms of detail. A strategy and a vision is a direction of travel. It isn't what are we going to do tomorrow. That comes out in a kind of implementation plan and in other ways, you know, roadmaps and things like that, but actually setting that vision and the strategy is aspirational. In some ways the vision is not achievable. And that's okay, and that's totally fine, but it gives you enough of a hook to kind of push the teams in a direction and keep that consistency. So even if you never actually achieve your vision, it's got to be enough to kind of push you onwards. And shoot, that for me is key.
What do they say? Shoot for the stars and land on the moon. Something
exactly,
like that.
Exactly. That's a great analogy.
And you talked about this during OUX happy hour about constantly showing the teams what's possible and getting them really excited about what's possible. So at Moorfields, what does that sound like when you're talking to them about what's possible?
So you've got to find the things that they're interested in and try and like speak in their language. So Moorfields is an NHS organization first and foremost, but it also has private options. So private patients are able to book and pay for treatment. So there's a commercial angle there. So if I'm talking to stakeholders who are, you know, the MD of the private hospital and consultants who operate in both private and NHS spaces, I might focus on more of the commercial angle. So if we do a good job here, we're going to boost revenue, we're going to boost appointments, we're going to boost all of the things that you're telling me you want to do. So that's a really good way of doing it. So find out what are the hooks are that are interested, that the stakeholders are interested in, and focus on kind of turning it around to their language. One of the key hooks for us, particularly as an organization, is kind of accessibility. So one of the, I guess, hooks that I put at the top of the business case was really making the case for, well, one, we have to be accessible. We are a public sector organization, but we have a legal responsibility to be compliant. But also, it just makes good sense. And it breeds good design, good practice. And so no one can really argue against that in a business sense. If I can use the language of, you know, really selling how this is going to improve you as stakeholders, your business, and the people that we serve, you're never really going to get the pushback.
Right. And I mean, specifically with accessibility, your organization being an eye hospital with probably people that might have vision issues, trying to use your digital platforms. So I can see that being a very clear argument for accessibility.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we do have a high proportion of our patients who are, you know, vision impaired, but accessibility isn't just for, you know, those with vision impairments. It, you know, really good accessibility is just good sense. And, you know, accessibility is accessibility for everyone. So, you know, take the example of electric teeth brushes or, you know, the dip in a curb, for example, which came up on your other podcast. But, you know, making a design for a group of people just helps everyone in the long run. Really, people with buggies are, you know, really benefited from lower curbs and not just people in wheelchairs. So it just makes good sense.
It's that concept of universal design. Exactly. We're going to make it better for everybody. So I definitely want to loop back to that and talk a bit more about accessibility and how structured content and OUX can potentially help with accessibility and kind of bake that thinking in earlier into the process. So it's not, I think a lot of times accessibility happens through band-aids after the system is launched and out there and live. And then you go and you go run it through an accessibility filter or something and find all the issues and start fixing those issues. So I do want to come back to that and talk about how OUX can help us preempt some of that stuff. But I think maybe there might be somebody listening. So for the people that are listening that are thinking, going back to PDFs, and this might be a good segue, going back to the PDFs, maybe for those that are listening thinking, wait, what is wrong with a PDF? What would you say to those folks?
Okay, how long have you got?
Let's do the high level.
So, well, PDF broadly is an inaccessible format. So it's very difficult for a screen reader to particularly engage with a content in a PDF. So if you're hiding what I call hiding content. So often what we do is just have a link and then everything is in the PDF, or at least that's what we do at Moorfields. So we're hiding content from being searchable, findable, even kind of rankable. You know, SEO is a really big part of finding content. And if you can't index that type of content, which you wouldn't necessarily be able to do in a PDF, then you're already going to be kind of losing out and you're kind of, you know, in giving people access to that content initially. But it's particularly bad for people who are using kind of assistive devices in being able to access, you know, the content in there.
Right. And why do you think organizations, so your organization is not the only one that is so PDF heavy. What is the cause of that? Like why?
Good question. No, I think what's happened, or at least from what I've observed at Moorfields, and I don't know if others are experiencing this, that often content processes or, you know, information processes start by being print first. Mm-hmm. Then you have the introduction of digital. What happens is that you don't think about digital as being a completely different format and a different way of presenting content, which it absolutely is, that you have teams who are sort of print first. The introduction of digital has just meant that they convert their text into something and put it live. And that is what they think is digitizing content, which absolutely isn't digitizing content. So part of what I have to do at Moorfields is try and demonstrate that this isn't about, this is also about changing how we approach content from the beginning and how we're actually thinking about how we present that content to a patient and structure that content around kind of what patients need. That, you know, what has happened. And part of this, you know, I don't think there's anything wrong with what's happened, but it's because there hasn't been perhaps the understanding of why that they're even kind of a different format and why that's bad, but also people who a lack of sort of competencies in the organization around sort of, you know, content, digital content roles specifically. So what you also have are kind of people who are print first and, you know, really good writers in their own way, but they're not digital writers, and they've just found a way of digitizing content, but they're not UX writers, they're not kind of thinking about content design, they're just finding a way. And that's not wrong, you know, that's what has happened in a lot of organizations. You haven't really invested in kind of content design, but now that's a real discipline, that's a real skill that we need to recognize more and more across organizations, particularly in the NHS, when you're dealing with really complex content. You know, medical information, health type content is really complex, you know, and this is kind of my, you know, kind of slight bugbear, but sort of also push for anyone in the NHS who's listening, that we need to invest in people who are really have those skills around structuring content, organizing content, writing content digitally. Like we need to invest in those skills. And if there's a little bit of a resurgence in kind of IA that I'm seeing kind of in the Twitter sphere, but we need a big resurgence of IA specialists, particularly in the health context. And I, you know, that's my kind of campaign.
And what does it mean to write digitally versus write for print?
Well, I think there's lots of kind of nuances there. I guess first and foremost, for me, it's thinking about writing for the user first and foremost. So writing and structuring content based on need and not based on kind of, you know, just a reflection of an organizational kind of, you know, structure. Considering how people kind of digest that information. So, you know, screens, screen sizes, resolution, you know, where they are, considering how people are going to take this information in. What kind of context are they going to be in? Is it going to be when they're frantically worrying about what's happening to them, you know, at 3 o'clock in the morning? How do I know what's wrong with my eye? How do I know where to go? How do I know what to do? So it's that sort of behavioral context as well. So understanding the state of mind, you know, how they might access this. Are they in transit? Are they on their phone? Are they sitting in front of a computer? Probably less likely, you know, with the latter at the moment. So it's considering all of those aspects when you're writing digitally. And I think what tends to happen is that we, you know, that doesn't happen, that we don't think enough about all of those different things. But yeah,
that makes a lot of sense. And then that structuring bit, you're moving, I think, from when you think about print, you've got a lot of those, what Karen McGrane calls the blobs, and then you're moving it into these chunks. So the content, we're kind of trying to get into the indivisible chunks of content, and knowing that the content might be like, where is the user coming from? It comes from that context. Are they clicking from here? Are they clicking from there? And then how do we also make content that is reusable? Right. I think you talk about having 13 definitions for cataracts on the site. So how do we say, okay, here's the definition for cataracts, and this might actually show up in 13 different places, but if we want to update it, we're going to only update it in the one place, and it'll go to all the 13 places it needs to show up.
Yeah. I mean, it's like having a design system for your content as well as you have for, you know, your atoms, your molecules, your organisms, your components, your whatever it is that you're using, what terminology you're using. the same applies for how you divide and organize your content for reuse. And that's absolutely valuable. Like those things for me seem to go more and more hand in hand, and certainly with the work that we're doing. And I'm sure we'll come on to that.
I feel like we're getting there, right? a design system for your content. How are we going to do that?
I think also it's really being confident. One of the things that I've been trying to push the organization on is also being really clear, like what you should be focusing on. So like from a content perspective, and this goes back to really having a clear understanding of what the, you know, your user journey kind of looks like. So from a hospital perspective, we need to know what's going on right from an initial kind of trigger moment. So if something happens to me, I hurt my eye, or I've had this kind of problem, there's something that's kind of triggering a symptom or whatever it is. That's the kind of initial stages of a sort of what we call a patient pathway or a patient journey. You know, lots of stuff going on there in terms of kind of self-research. You're probably frantically Googling stuff. You're asking friends and family. Then you're probably going to go and talk to a GP or a kind of medical professional. Now, where Moorfields kind of comes in that journey is not at that beginning stage. So trying to push the organization to really be clear on where does the journey start for Moorfields in a journey context. The stuff that's happening at the beginning, but that's where we refer to our sort of national services. So the NHS UK is our kind of national kind of website. That's where a lot of the content is for things like symptoms and triggers and changes. We don't need to compete at the hospital level with stuff that's going on nationally. And there's no point in doing that, because from an SEO search perspective, we're never going to beat them in rankings anyway. So we should be better at referring where appropriate and syndicating where appropriate. Mm-hmm. But then focusing on what is our unique position in this patient pathway, which is from a hospital setting, particularly Moorfields as a specialist trust, at the point of referral. So it's not those kind of initial stages and engagement with your GP and kind of doing that sort of initial research. It's once you've got an appointment and once they've decided that you need to go somewhere specialist, that's where the journey starts.
And that is so... I think that is one of the biggest problems and one of the biggest struggles that folks have from a strategy perspective is figuring out where their edges are, figuring out where the boundaries, where the scope is, and then also understanding that wider context. So Jorge Arango was talking about it in the last episode about you always need to be thinking about the wider context. And what you're adding to that is not only thinking about the wider context, but be very clear about what your responsibility is. Where are you pulling content in? Where are you referring out? Who is doing what here within this patient journey? And what's, you know, where's our unique boundary for how we're helping the patient in your case?
Absolutely key. And also because I think what we're trying to do as an eye hospital, like even though we are an eye hospital, we're sort of a world leading eye hospital, it still doesn't mean that we own the definition of eye condition. So, mm-hmm. I don't know who actually the owner is. Probably like the Royal College of Ophthalmology, who, you know, where our consultants go to train and learn about conditions.
Right.
They are the owner of what is an eye condition. But we don't need to worry too much about like owning that kind of content. Like we don't even need to really worry about providing that type of content. People aren't coming to us to find what is cataracts. Because our journey starts sort of midway through, it's more about how are we treating that condition? What's going to happen to you when you come here? How long is it going to take? Is it going to hurt? All of these kind of things that we should be focusing on. And we should be tailoring our experience around more kind of the treatment end of a condition. How do you treat it? What's going to happen? What's the aftercare? What do I do once I've had surgery? All of those type of things we should be doing much better on and kind of forget, not necessarily forget, but we just don't need to compete or worry about the kind of general kind of content. Be specific and be focused and be confident with that decision as well. And having said that, there are some nuances and differences between NHS patients and private. Now, you could argue that there's a commercial competitive angle with private patients. So actually, we want to be visible at a much earlier point of a journey. But again, that's not general content, that's specific things that we offer. So laser eye surgery and cosmetic surgery and the things that we are actually offering a private patient, you know, that's where we can focus our kind of SEO strategy. But it's really specific then. It's not trying to do everything.
So this is something, this is a question that I get a lot, and probably questions you're getting from your team and your stakeholders about defining that scope. And we talk about in OUX, we talk about the domain model versus the system model. So that domain model, having that wider context, understanding the domain, understanding that wider customer journey, and then being very clear on what are the objects within your system that you have control over, and then what objects might even bring pieces of content. So just as an example, you might have cataract surgery as the treatment. So treatment or procedure might be an object within your system, but the definition of cataracts, you're going to be pulling that in. So the actual condition might be outside of your system, or the definition of the condition. So how do you figure all that out? How do you document that? And kind of what's your like mapping process?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's where kind of the object-oriented UX process really came into its own and triggered those specific conversations. So when you get to the level of, so imagine you've got your objects already defined, condition is a key object for us. Then when you start to break down, okay, what are the attributes and the metadata that make up that object of condition? And you start to think about, we went through workshops, so many workshops to define those attributes and rank them and prioritize them. Like you should see my mural account. It's just insane. Board after board after board of workshop where we were getting into that granularity. And I was pushing the stakeholders partly because we've never gone through this kind of process before as an organization. So the website, you know, is this kind of, you know, showcase for PDFs that has sort of been live for about 8 years and just sort of organically grown, but no one has ever built it with a kind of, you know, with this kind of process in mind at all. And so we're trying to introduce like a completely different way of thinking about content. So I was really pushing the organization to think, you know, what would you define? How would you define a condition? And how would you break down a condition? What are the pieces of content that we need? And if you start them off, you know, give them some suggestions. Symptoms seems like a really obvious one, a definition. It might have a name, it might have two names, it might have an English, you know, plain English name, it might have a scientific or medical name. And once they've got into the mindset of actually, oh, okay, I understand what you're asking me to do, lots of attributes start coming out. So I think
wow. The floodgates open.
Yeah, they never end. So for each object, I think we probably had about like 30 to 40 attributes. And then from that, you can start to just ask some of those really tricky questions. Okay, well, let's take the definition of a condition and just ask the question, who owns that definition? Where does that definition come from? And I was particularly keen to kind of push those type of conversations with clinicians particularly, partly because I wanted to understand, like, how much do we defer to other organizations? Like, do we own the definition of cataracts? Like my hypothesis was that I didn't think we did. But just asking those questions and, you know, first question that anyone probably has ever asked, who owns the definition of cataracts? Is it us? No. Okay. Who does own it? Where should it come from? It did actually lead us into looking at the API for the NHS UK website to syndicate some of that content. But actually what's interesting about the API is that it doesn't allow you to syndicate at the attribute level. So it only allows you to take all or nothing. And that's slightly unfortunate because what we want are really only attributes of condition. So it doesn't enable us to do that. So we might have to wait for that.
Interesting. Oh, that's so interesting. So are you having those conversations with the NHS and say, we need a more granular API. We need you all to do some work on your API because we don't want to duplicate this content.
Yeah, we certainly did say, you know, what we were using it for and what our kind of need was. I guess they would need to evaluate, you know, on their roadmap of, you know, improvements, where does that kind of fit into? So it probably isn't something that, it might be something if other people start thinking about you know, syndication content from the center. I doubt anyone has asked for that.
I mean, we're going off script quite a bit here. That's all. No, it's my fault, definitely. But no, it's a good thing. But I'm curious. I'm going to show my ignorance about APIs, and I'm very excited. Carolyn Sober James is going to be doing an OUX happy hour just on OUX and APIs. But so if you're getting all of that information in, can't you filter it out? Can't you build something in between to say, okay, we're going to get all of this, but we just want to pull this piece? Or is that just going to, why can't you do that?
Yeah, in theory, the challenge of what currently happens though, is that you'd have to tailor that for each object. So because of the way they've structured the API as a kind of all or nothing approach, because each condition would have kind of slightly different attributes, there wouldn't be a way of doing that that would make sense to kind of as a sort of, you know, global rule or at the object level rule. It just wouldn't work. So yeah, that's the challenge. Like, yes, in theory, an API should be able to do that, and you certainly can like build them to do that.
Right.
But because of the way they structured their content, one, that's not consistent across all conditions. And two, the way that you pull it would then mean that you would have to redesign it at each. For
yes.
Each
so object. Basically, because they haven't used object-oriented UX, it's coming downstream where basically it sounds like every condition is a little bit of its own special snowflake. It doesn't have that consistent structure. So you would have to be pulling that at an instance level.
Yeah, exactly. And what we're trying to do on our end is, so we are having a sort of aiming for a sort of object level or a condition, set of attributes that some may be complete, some may be not, depending on the condition. But if we can capture, you know, all of the ones that we need across all conditions, and then in our kind of design template, if you don't fill out, it doesn't get displayed. So we're trying to be as kind of reusable as possible, but recognizing that there are going to be nuances. So some conditions, for example, won't have treatment options because they're not treatable or, you know, whatever.
Yes, that makes total sense. You're going to have some sort of little bit of conditional logic there at the object level, but that field still exists. So yeah. that'll make more fields such a nicer player in the API world because of how you're structuring your content.
Exactly. And I guess part of what we're trying to do is build it in a way that could be reused. So, you know, partly that we want to reuse it for different things. I guess that's our sort of main requirement, that perhaps we want to use it for a voice skill or a mobile app or whatever it is, across different, digital products. But also enabling others to perhaps indicate from us, you know, that there might be other eye hospitals or other local services that perhaps want to take some of our content.
That's amazing. I mean, it's positioning you as a leader and a source.
Yeah, and it's making sure that we're, you know, even architecturally, so both technically and from a content perspective, that we're building in this kind of sustainable approach that can be reused in the future if we have, you know, a need to reuse it in another way, but also building the kind of the technical architecture that we can expand. So we know we're going to be doing some integrations later. We're not going to be doing those now, but because we know they're coming and having that kind of always that view on kind of what's possible, what's coming, what's on the roadmap for the future, that we make sure we architecturally design so that, you know, we don't have to retract or repeat, but that we can build on the stuff that we're doing. So that's is really important for me in my approach, to always make those kind of as much as possible sustainable decisions.
Moorfields is very lucky to have you. I hope that, you know, and I see how you're going to become, and Moorfields is going to become an example within the NHS, and hopefully this kind of thinking starts spreading throughout the entire organization. Okay, so we need to talk about object-oriented UX, and for those, which we've been dancing around it. But for those that that might be listening to the, you know, that they're starting the object-oriented UX podcast with this conversation right here, Can you, you know, I can define object-oriented UX all day, but can you explain for those that are, might have no idea what object-oriented UX is, or maybe just an inkling based on our conversation, how would you explain object-oriented UX?
Yeah, so I was thinking about this earlier because I felt like you were going to ask me this. And I was like, what is my answer? And I looked back actually at what, so when you do the object-oriented UX certification exam, one of the exam questions is, what is your definition? And it's really great way of starting the exam and just sort of really thinking about, okay, how would I define this? And how I defined it has changed, I think. Having used it in like the way that we've kind of used it in practice and kind of really thinking about how to actually apply object thinking across all aspects of the product development work that we're doing. So in it, my initial definition was that, so imagine that the design double diamond, which I hope everyone is kind of familiar with, and that there's a really great illustration that I think one of the UXers has done, which slots the OOX process or the ORCA process in between the double diamond. Now, that is helpful. And when I initially engaged with this process, it was a little bit of a light bulb moment for me that I'd always felt like there was a cognitive leap between discovery, definition, and then jumping into wireframe. Like it always felt like a massive jump. Like discovery and definition feel quite nice and contained, and you know, you'd end up with maybe a bunch of user stories at the end of your kind of definition phase, maybe depending on how you work and what you do, or some sort of revisited brief or rewritten brief. But that feels nice and contained, and then suddenly you get this the second diamond and it feels like a leap. So the initial definition I wrote was that it really slotted nicely for me between discovery, definition, and the kind of next stages of product exploration and wireframing. I still stand by that, as you know, it is a really useful bridge between those two diamonds and between those two things, which I always felt were a cognitive leap. But for me, it's really about having that relentless focus on objects that even at the discovery phase can be defined and discovered by your users. And it just is a, so I think now OOX is like running all the way through those stuff. Like we need a new illustration that you're not thinking about objects in discovery. You're absolutely thinking about objects in discovery, but you might do a bunch of interviews first and then you might do kind of noun foraging a specific exercise. But you are thinking about objects right from the outset, right from discovery. And so for me, it's now, how I would define it now is having that relentless focus on objects that are defined by your users, but helps to keep everything on the same hymn sheet all the way through, from stakeholders to developers, from discovery to ideation and to product development. And what it's really helped us at Moorfields do is connect the team, because we've been sort of separate for quite a long time because I've been in a weird sort of procurement process. So I haven't had developers, I haven't had service designers, I haven't had user researchers until April. So we were going through the kind of OOX process, just myself and Rachel and my team, for quite a long time, engaging patients, engaging stakeholders, really defining, doing that discovery piece. And then I suddenly had like a full stack delivery team and I needed to kind of get them up to speed with the stuff we'd done already, which was like a year's worth of work, and the kind of the object thinking. But it really wasn't that difficult to get them on board, because if you speak in the language of objects, it's suddenly just really easy for people to engage. You know, we've been really able to get developers on board super, super quickly, to get designers up to speed really quickly. And we've brought in the object focus at every single conversation. So if we're doing a service blueprint, for example, which is one of the first things we did as a new collective team, was think about, okay, we're thinking about the user journey. What are the interaction points? What is a patient doing? Where are they going? Where are they seeking information? You know, alongside that, thinking about, okay, what does that mean from an object perspective? Where do the objects come in and how do they, you know, work alongside that kind of service blueprint? So we started thinking about objects there. We started to think about objects in relation to user stories. So how we're defining our backlog and how we're structuring our backlog in Jira is all kind of object-based. How we're building our roadmap is all object-based. how we're structuring our kind of components and our templates and our content types is all object-based. Functionality is all object-based. And so it's been this just relentless focus. And I think it, for me, it doesn't slot in the middle now. It's kind of, we need a new illustration that covers of that whole process. I don't know, it's a very long definition.
it bleeds into both of the diamonds, definitely. Like, it kind of, like you might start doing it the first time you do it, it might be like, okay, we're going to take all of our research because we haven't necessarily changed how we do research and how we do discovery. And we're going to pull that all that into the Orca process. And then we're going to spit it out into the design world. But then definitely it kind of starts bleeding over, which is amazing to hear that that's what's happened for you. So
yeah, absolutely. And I was thinking about this the other day, like, what, I wouldn't be able to do it any other way. I don't think it doesn't make sense. So it just, it totally makes sense when we're having, you know, daily stand-ups that it's, you know, we're talking about those objects. We're defining our beta on the prioritized objects. So we're only looking at kind of five initially, but we've got probably 11 on the table that we want to get to eventually. But, you know, our IA is structured around our objects. Our content model is structured around our objects. Everything hinges from the objects. And it's just really, I think, and I'd love to hear, you know, what the guys think, whether they genuinely agree with the statement, but it helped everyone get on board super quickly with what we were doing. And often when you engage, you know, with an agency or, you know, someone comes in who's new, there's a really quick learning curve. And it really helped with that initial kind of learning curve. They had a whole year's worth of discovery to kind of digest. And it just really helped that focus. And the other thing it really helps me as someone who engages with stakeholders on a daily basis is because our objects are defined by our users. Yes, we've engaged stakeholders in that process as well, but we've run, you know, noun foraging workshops with patients and attribute discovery with patients that I can, you know, I go back to stakeholders to remind them, like, these are the things that are bringing most value to our patients because we've engaged them in this process. So when it's just helpful for me when I go to board meetings and when I'm presenting on project updates, I can talk in relation to the objects that we've defined. And even the project board updates that I do are object based.
That's amazing. You know,
yeah.
So what, why do you think, so as you brought on this, so for a little bit of context, you were bringing on this, this delivery partner to actually help implement all this work. And you were specifically looking for somebody to help create a headless CMS, correct?
Yeah, well, the remit of what they're doing is, so the scope of work they're doing is around designing a new digital service for patients. So it wasn't specifically around bringing in a headless CMS. A headless CMS is part of that. But we are designing a new digital service for patients. Now, part of this fits into the strategy that we're kind of developing at Morphos, which is around a single access point or a single front door for our patients. So what we have currently is kind of many front doors and many pseudo front doors. So we've got text messages and letters, they're a front door. We've got about 30 different websites. We've got other front doors like platforms. So we've got patient portal platforms. We've got CRM systems. We've got all sorts of other things, which are sort of front doors. What I'm trying to do is build a single front door, a single access, which we're not going to achieve overnight. So for me, that's kind of a five-year thing. In 5 years, we might get there. What we're focusing on initially is being able to retire some of those front doors and amalgamate that experience for both NHS and private patients into kind of one offer. So we're focusing our attention on those kind of core objects of condition, consultant, location, what we're calling article/story at the moment. And then we've got sort of aspects of appointment. But the full blown appointment feature probably going to be later down the line when we're going to be doing integration pieces, because they're sort of big ticket items. So we're initially focusing on what can we do initially in our beta phase, which takes us up to October, to be able to start to retire some of our front doors and consolidate that offer. So it's a bit, it's a lot more consistent and it's really well designed, really well structured, and does, you know, it sort of boosts our brand, which is, you know, one aspect of this project, and serves both NHS and private patients.
Hey y'all, just a quick interruption. As of this recording, we are in the midst of cohort 4 of the OUX certification, and enrollment for cohort 5 won't open up until early summer 2021. But you can dig into all the certification video content, all the templates, all the resources by grabbing access to the OUX Masterclass. And if, after going through the masterclass, you want to get certified, you'll be able to apply the cost of the masterclass to your enrollment in cohort 5. So you can kind of think about it like a down payment. Once you enroll in the masterclass, you'll get access to the OUX Academy, and over the course of 10 weeks, about 2 to 3 hours of video lectures will be released to you each week. But you can consume that content totally at your own pace. You'll have lifetime access to it. So if it takes you 20 weeks to go through it, that's totally fine. You're not just gonna get video content. You're gonna get checklists. You're gonna get exercises. You're gonna get assignments and tons of valuable resources. Basically everything you need to become an expert complexity wrangler. Again, you get everything that a certification cohort gets, just minus all those personal touches. The camaraderie of the cohort, in the OUX forum, access to the OUX mentors, the one-on-ones with me, as well as me answering all your questions in the forum and in office hours, and of course the actual certification and a profile on OUX.com. So for all of that, you'll need to actually join a cohort. But you don't have to wait. You can start becoming that complexity wrangling, stakeholder whispering, IA facilitator extraordinaire now. You can start saving yourself and your team countless hours of rework, and you can start saving your user from the extraneous complexity that OUX helps you avoid. So go to OUX.com/certification to learn more. From there, you can get on the waitlist for cohort 5, as well as get yourself access to that entire video library that is the OUX Masterclass. Still not sure if you're ready to take the plunge? Go check out the testimonials on OUX.com. Okay, back to the show.
So why, when you were bringing on these development partners, why do you think presenting to them and kind of onboarding them for like a year's worth of work, why did this relentless object focus make that easy? Why do you think that made it easier?
I mean, I think it really goes back to, like, you know, the whole philosophy behind object-oriented UX is that everyone thinks in objects. And like, this is kind of testament to that, like, philosophy, really, that if I describe things in objects, people have a kind of like a really clear understanding very quickly of what I'm talking about. So I think it really just boosts why we're doing this in the first place, that people think in objects. Yes, if I explain it in objects, people are going to follow me. Also, I'm talking about, you know, I'm explaining it in the process that we've done. So here's the process. Here's how we got to these objects. But also, like, from, you know, if you look at Moorfields Hospital, if you spent half an hour just looking at the website with no experience whatsoever, and I asked you to give me 5 objects, you probably would come up with some of those ones that are on the table: condition, location, appointment, certainly. So when you do that, it seems very obvious.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And actually what we found was that, you know, even if I did that, you know, I did do a lot of those type of exercises at the beginning where, like, I got people to noun forage from specific sources, but also asking them to kind of really just, you know, if I asked you to pick 5 objects, what would you pick? And those are the ones that come up time and time again. Now, it might seem obvious, but the point is that we've gone through that kind of consolidated approach to validate that these are the right things, even if the same 5 are on the table now than when they were when I did summer school in August on my own. That's fine. That's not a problem. That's just really good evidence that we're confident in what we're doing.
Also, I think, I mean, getting everybody speaking the same language. So with developers and stakeholders and the design team, that you're using the same words for these things.
Yeah, exactly.
I can imagine it's helpful as well.
Yeah, it's really where it gets complicated is where you start the attribute level gets complicated anyway, mm-hmm. because how do you define something? That's always a really difficult exercise. So at the attribute level, it becomes complex. Some of our objects have been objects. Some of them have suddenly become attributes. They've gone back to objects. They've got deleted.
Right.
And that just shows the sort of complexity of some of the sort of the taxonomy kind of challenges that we have in a health context, that we just have a lot of complex terminology to try and organize and arrange. So treatment and condition are the two things that are like literally like, it's not an object today, it is an object tomorrow, it's not. And partly, so when we started prototyping, so we're at the stage now where we're prototyping. We've done some prototype, really early prototype testing with patients, primarily looking at how do we bring NHS and private content together. So that's our sort of initial focus at the moment, and how do we kind of represent ourselves more as sort of location agnostic. So those have been our initial sort of prototype focuses. And it's just been really interesting to kind of delve into some of those. So we started initially by mocking up a really generic, because it was really easy to do a generic kind of condition page. We did a prototype around it and we've tested it. But what's come out of that testing is more kind of evidence to suggest that people don't want generic pages, content layouts. They want what they need to access, which is why you need to get down into that attribute level mm-hmm. to focus on the things and the bits of content that are most relevant to them and their need. And that's where treatments now are like main focus. So it is an object to a certain extent, but it's so intertwined with condition that they're like objects that are so stuck together.
yeah. So does a condition have multiple treatments, or could it have multiple treatments? Or
absolutely. Yeah. It could have nothing, and mm-hmm. it could have multiple. So there's complexity there. But because it's the main thing that people are really coming to us for information on, that it had to be. So we kind of abandoned the prototype in terms of that sort of generic layout. Like, here's the definition, here's the symptoms. Like, we don't need that. Just forget that. Let's just go straight in, like, treatment options, treatment information. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And the other challenge that we've got right now is connecting up with the communications that we're sending to our patients. So the text messages that we're sending about appointment reminders, the appointment letters that we're sending. Now, it's a real challenge because some conditions like cataract, let's go back to cataract. It's a really nice, easy example. Cataract is the name of the condition. It's also the name of the thing that you're going to see in your letter. So, dear so-and-so, you know, you've been referred to Moorfields for an assessment because of cataract at location X. That's the thing that's written in your letter. So that's mm-hmm. now the thing that I'm going to see. And perhaps that becomes now my search term that I'm going to go to the website to find information on. That's a nice, easy one. But what we don't do is like consistent labeling. So here's mm-hmm. back to that IA conundrum. Another example is a term which we call adnexal. Now, adnexal is the name of a collection of conditions, or a collection of symptoms, I should say. But that's the thing that we're going to put in your letter because it's now associated with a location. You've been invited to come to the adnexal clinic on X day with X consultant. Now, adnexal is not the name of a condition, but I might be a patient and see that and think, oh, I've got adnexal. Uh-huh. So I'm going to look for that term on the website in relation to a condition. It isn't the name of a condition, though, but that's where I might go. Wow. It's actually in relation to a location. So how do we kind of join up our structure and our labeling to make sure that, you know, they're looking at these terms in the letter, which is just a reflection of how we actually structure ourselves as an organization, but not how we're thinking of, you know, what we're putting in the letter might be a search term, you know, in Google, and kind of joining up those things. That's the challenge that we've got at the moment.
It's that question of kind of where do you put the tomato? Is a tomato a fruit?
Exactly.
Technically it's a fruit, but it really belongs in vegetables. The cliche IA example of like doing it user centered versus like biologically centered or technically centered. This kind of goes into one of the last questions I want to ask, which is about when we were talking about that kind of relentless object focus that bled into research, into that discovery. And I know that part of that for you was doing a content inventory and a content audit. And I can see that some of that that insight would have come out of that process, so that you didn't just use cataracts as the example. You also had all these other examples and started to figure out kind of maybe where those were categorized. Can you talk more about the process of doing an inventory and a content audit?
Yeah, so we did a bunch of stuff in relation to content. So one of the first things we did was, so we did do an inventory and we did start to audit in a sort of classic content inventory audit sense. So that started before I went through the object-oriented UX process. So it was a sort of standard, you know, build an inventory. We've got 10,000 assets we want to individually go and look at in terms of quality, in terms of reading age, in terms of UX, in terms of performance, all of those things that you kind of want to measure when you're doing an audit and kind of do that page by page and PDF by PDF. So we started that. Then I was introduced to this process and we kind of abandoned ship on that because one of the things that struggled with immediately was bringing it back to objects. So we remember we had that conversation in the summer around how do you then refocus your content audit to be object focused. So, you know, even just adding that as just a field in the audit is what object is this related to, and just trying to capture some of that information. So we started before Ux, we parked it, then we tried to make it object focused, and we have kind of kept that format, but we hit another challenge when we started. So when the supplier got on board and we were kind of moving through the kind of product development stages and we started doing service blueprinting and we started thinking about where we might go with our kind of initial prototype and what that might look like, we hit more roadblocks with the content audit process, partly because there's so much content that is not user focused, and we've inherited this like structure that is, you know, 8 years old that has never gone through this kind of lens before or this kind of process before. And we felt like we were auditing something that we knew we were just going to abandon, to be honest. So we've kind of now like inverted that whole process. And we've basically just started designing from the ground up instead of what we actually need in relation to those objects. Now, there is an aspect of going back into the audit to check where some of those attributes, where we want to reuse that content. So now the audit is focused on not assessing what's there from an audit perspective in terms of performance, because we know that it's all crap. But in relation to the attributes of the objects that we have defined in this process, just going back to check what can be reused. Yes. In the new world. So we're basically starting again, but using it now as a can we reuse some of the content, because some of the content is really, you know, we've got subject matter experts across the organization who really know their stuff, and there is some great content in these PDFs. So it's now just a focus of where can we reuse stuff to get it ready for our kind of new digital service, which essentially is just kind of rebuilt from the ground up. So we've kind of gone on a massive journey. The other thing we did was did a card sorting exercise with stakeholders just on what we currently had. And it was just so telling because like no one could define it. Wow. Yeah.
So it sounds like, I mean, I'm wondering, I'm kind of spitballing here, but I'm wondering if something that would be valuable, and sounds like this is sort of what you're doing, is doing more of an instance audit. So not necessarily auditing for rot, and then because you know, okay, we're going to be looking at all of these pieces, but really figuring out, okay, if we kind of know what our objects are, let's go find a bunch of instances, or find, yeah, oh, here's a bunch of instances and they don't fit into one of the objects that we've defined. We maybe need a new object because this is a different type of animal. And really having that ability to say, okay, well, we've got, what was the add, the condition, the kind of condition thing, the group
add nexel.
Adnexal. So we have this adnexal thing, like what kind of animal is adnexal? But it, and how is cataracts? And then like, okay, we have cataracts, and then we have cataract surgery, and then we have the, you know, cataracts therapy or something else, like these other just like getting this really nice understanding of what all the instances are, or at least a good sample set of the instances. Yeah, so you can exactly start thinking about those edge cases.
Yeah, but that's exactly what we're doing. So we're collecting those instances at the moment for the prototype, so but a really sort of small subset. So starting with kind of, you know, 4 or 5 kind of key common conditions, so cataracts, glaucoma, so the obvious ones, and then picking some of the more obscure ones to see, like, again, a test for, you know, does the set of attributes work across all, you know, does it work for some of the rare conditions or does it not? So yeah, absolutely that. At the instance level, we are at least seeing what we've got and seeing where we can kind of reuse that. And then we've got now like an Uber spreadsheet, which is like what, you know, all of the objects on along the bottom in their own tabs, and then all the attributes. And we're just, we've got like, that's where we're putting all of our content in the moment, in just in a massive spreadsheet with objects at the bottom and attributes in each tab. Yeah. And we're just collecting that as we go along. So it's a big, we've got a big content overhead to kind of try and figure out, and a lot of noise that was just kind of getting in the way that we've just now kind of abandoned, which I think is the right approach.
Yeah, that's amazing. So and definitely how I've started thinking about what that kind of audit might look like and how to sort of adapt a content audit to make it a lot more efficient in this world where sometimes, you know, pulling in, if you have 3,000 instances, pulling all of that in and auditing every line of 3,000 instances is just kind of unrealistic. So my very last question for you, I'm going to channel some folks in the audience. Some people might be thinking that this sounds very waterfall. I'm going to use the dirty word that, like, okay, you did about a year of doing this work and now you're bringing on a dev partner, which I know that there was some kind of like just considerations. You don't have a dev team. So what I want to ask you is, where does iteration play in this? How are you, because I know that you are, but how are you iterating on the design and also plan to be iterating on the development? And kind of what is that? How are you balancing this idea of iteration versus like doing quite a bit of design work up front?
Yeah, so it's a real active challenge, actually. I don't think we've totally nailed it. So the development partner did come with not just developers. So we've got service designers, we've got user researchers, we've got product designers. So wow. They're doing design and build because I just don't have the resources to do that internally. So the beauty of that is that we started with kind of a sort of pseudo discovery as a collective together. And that was, I guess, maybe more of a 2-week onboarding. We called it a bit of a discovery phase, but really it was like get up to speed and collectively work on. So we started with the service blueprint as a collective because they needed to understand the lay of the land. We wanted to make sure that we had a kind of really good joining up of thought. They could see where we were going in this kind of process. And so that was where we started. So we ran a sort of pseudo discovery phase together before we've kind of started our sprint. We actually only started dev sprints this week. This is the first beta sprint. And then we moved into kind of an alpha phase. Now, alpha phase was really, again, more of an extension of discovery in the sense that, you know, we've got a more refined idea of our hypothesis that we want to validate or disprove. We went through a whole process of really refining those things and, you know, getting to the stage at the end of alpha where we've got a really good kind of focused prototype. What the dev side has been sort of in parallel, the conversations with the technology side is really about what technology do we need to support where we're going. Mm-hmm. So technical decisions about architecture, about the CMS, doing a lot of work looking initially. So I guess sort of a technical discovery was running in parallel to that, you could call it, which was really thinking about what technology decisions do we need to make to support this that we keep talking about and that we're planning and that we've got a vision for. Doing some assessments of kind of CMS technology, was headless the right approach? Were there other options? You know, doing some evaluation around hosting platforms, where should we put this, all of those kind of stuff. And also there's a bunch of stuff we have to do in the NHS to make sure that's totally sound and tick all the information governance boxes and all of those kind of stuff. So there's a lot of setup. Alongside that was conversations around how do we make sure that a user story that goes into the backlog is not an unvalidated story with users.
Right.
So I guess like setting those kind of ground rules really is key. So as a team, we've collectively said no user story will be picked up by a dev unless it's gone through the design and testing cycle to ensure that that's a validated user story that should get developed. And you, just have that conversation, be upfront about some of those kind of principles and some of those rules. Yes, devs might get frustrated that they don't have our like component library from day one. They don't even have a high fidelity design yet. We're still working on that. But we can establish our basic principles for going into the sprint cycles, that actually what we're going to find is that the design cycles are 2 or 3 weeks ahead of what's going into the dev cycle, because at the moment they're focused on standing up the application and doing all the architecture. So they don't need designs yet. So we're sort of beavering away at getting the designs ready. So in 2 sprints time, when they're ready to apply some styling to some of the, you know, building some of those components, that we'll be way ahead. And so that's the trick. So making sure that the design cycles, so we're testing with users in every sprint, but we are 2 or 3 weeks ahead of the development. So we can pass over validated user stories, and just making sure that the backlog is a, you know, representation of what's coming, but also they're validated. So, and you know, a developer is picking up a validated user story. But so then you've got also the testing cycles at the other end. So the quality testing, the accessibility testing, all of that stuff. Yeah, so it's tricky. I don't think anyone's got it totally sound, but open dialogue.
I mean, I feel like that's such an amazing, I mean, the fact that you had, and I'm wondering, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but because you had that object map, you had all that object-based thinking, do you feel like that helps with the developers to be able to kind of do some of that technical architecture work while?
Yeah, because they've already got an idea of what the objects are. And so they, even if they've got no designs, they understand that, you know, an object needs to talk to another object. And that actually they can just, you know, we can give them four examples of a condition, even if there's no content in there. They can still start to think about how the relationships are going to work, because we've already established that, you know, integrated content is really key, as you know, what we're trying to achieve. So they can already, you know, without any design, think about how does an object relate to another object.
Right. So so the design team is not a bottleneck. They can actually move forward. That's amazing. So before we wrap up, is there any last words, anything else you want to say to the Objector UX community and anybody that might be thinking about giving this a go?
I mean, don't hesitate. You know, I really, really love this process, and I bang on about it all the time with friends. So in other contexts, a friend who's just signed up for the cohort, who I've been talking to about it, who works for, you know, Royal Gardens, really exciting. There's your ticket to the Queen there. and other friends who are working in the health space who are hitting kind of similar conundrums. Around, you know, I work with a bunch of stakeholders, you know, what techniques, what tools can I use to, you know, understand my way out of this? Like, here, try this. And I'm mentoring someone at the moment who's never done the course, has never done the cohort, but is applying some of the thinking and some of the techniques. And I'm checking in with her sort of every couple of weeks. So she works for another organization. It's not a hospital. It's an NHS organization, but it's very different. They're sort of an agency within the NHS. So they work with lots of stakeholders and they have lots of clients. And she's really finding this as a helpful approach. So I would encourage people to look into it, try it out. And if you've, you know, very happy to also be available for questions or for mentoring if people want to. I'm really happy to kind of chat about it. I mean, I love a chat. So
we will definitely link all of your contact information. Probably LinkedIn would be the best way for people to reach you, or is there, or Twitter?
Yeah, that's fine.
I'll put link either one. Okay. we'll put LinkedIn and Twitter in the show notes so that you can contact Imogen if you do have more questions. Thank you so much for this conversation. It's been incredibly valuable for me to hear it. I know it's gonna be really valuable for everybody else that's listening. So thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for listening. I truly hope you enjoyed this episode. Please visit objectorientux.com/podcast for show notes. Our soundtrack is Fighter by Ruby Vell, courtesy of Sugaroo Records. Happy OUXing!